Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for this channel. Today we'll be talking with James Carl Nelson about his new book, I Will Hold, the story of United States Marine Corps legend Clifton B. Cates, from below wood to victory in the Great War. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
I'm now the author of three World War I books, somehow just by happenstance. My first book was The Remains of Company D, which is about my grandfather's unit of the 1st Division, followed by Five Lieutenants, which followed five Harvard grads through the war to their ultimate fates. Otherwise, I'm originally from Chicago, went to the University of Minnesota, studied journalism. I've been a working journalist for 33 years, and just have really enjoyed segueing into writing these military histories that I do.
Okay. And so you got into the business, if you will, of writing these military histories from that desire to explore some, your grandfather's background?
It's funny. He lived to be 101, but he was shot and severely wounded at Soissons on July 19, 1918. It's just a small story of him laying over night on the ground, almost mortally wounded, being picked up by a couple of colonial stretcher bearers and brought to aid and made it back. He lived another 75 years. And I never really fleshed it out with him when he was alive. But after he died in 1993, for some reason, it was got this bug to what really was that story, that little nugget he used to tell? What was the context of that? And one day I got a muster roll from the 1st Division Museum in Wheaton, Illinois, and his name was on it. He was missing since recent operations, but there all these other names surrounding it. And it just really intrigued me, and I kind of delved in and started researching the men of his company, which is Company D, 28th Infantry, U.S. 1st Division.
So you started writing these books about combat in World War I. What led you to the story of Clifton Cates?
Basically, in both books, The Remains of Company D and Five Lieutenants, I had covered portions of the Battle of Soissons from the 1st Division's perspective. It was a huge counteroffensive launched on July 18, 1918, meant to slice through this huge hanging pocket that the Germans had created during their advance south to the Marne. And then 1st Division was on the north, the Moroccans were in the middle, and the 2nd Division, which included the 4th Brigade, which was Marines, were on the south. So I wrote a proposal for my agent just saying, how about a standalone book about the Battle of Soissons? It's a four-day affair. And he's an author himself, Jim Hornfisher. He's done a number of naval books from World War II, including Neptune's Inferno, which covered Guadalcanal, and he recognized the name Clifton Cates and said, well, what about a biography of this guy? Because he was aware that Cates had become a commandant of the Marine Corps. So a quick check showed that he had his papers. Cates had papers at the Quantico Marine Archives, and a short trip over there, gathered his material. It was originally supposed to be a full-blown life biography, but it turned out to be fortuitous that his World War II records and after were all had been sent out to be digitalized. So I waited and waited and waited, and finally, I waited for like a year and a half, 2 years, I swear to God. And finally, I just rewrote the proposal, and I just said, let's just make it World War I. And actually, in terms of action, he was in the thick of combat as a second lieutenant and a captain. You know, once he was with the Marines in World War II, he was a colonel and a general. So really, the dramatic combat stuff was in World War I. So it worked out well.
Okay. So tell us something about Cates' background. He grew up post-Civil War America. What was his early life like?
Well, I was born in 1893, and he was born at his family's place, appropriately called Cates Landing on the Mississippi River in far northwest Tennessee, near the bend of Cairo, up in there where they had earthquakes over the years. And his family basically were not human farmers, but they had a sizable, you could call it a plantation, I guess. And they also had a general store. River boats would stop there and unload or load supplies. They grew cotton. So he grew up, it wasn't a genteel Southern type of upbringing, but they were well off. But he spent most of his childhood avoiding schoolwork and running around in the running around in the woods. He was really a man of action from the get-go. He didn't really take to the rigidity of sitting at a desk in a school. He went to a country schoolhouse first, but eventually he was consumed with the woods and sort of I liken it to a Tom Sawyer upbringing or Huck Finn on the Mississippi River. He ultimately got sent to the Missouri Military Academy, which is right across the river. And I'm not sure, I don't really know how that came about. If they felt he needed some disciplining for his studies and just in general, because there wasn't really much of a military lineage in the Cates family. Then he went on to the University of Tennessee, studied law, and graduated in 1916. And he was actually set on taking the bar exams when war was declared on April 6, 1917, and he was in Knoxville. And he asked, he saw the son of the university son of the president of the university strolling by, and asked him if his dad had gotten any inquiries about recruiting people from the U. And the guy said, yeah, he got an inquiry from the Marines, the Marine Corps. And Cates looked at him and said, "The Marine Corps? What's that?" So, you know, it was, and that's the thing about the Marines. I mean, we think of the Marines now; everybody knows what the Marines are. But back then, it was a more obscure force. They were attached to the Navy, and they served in dribs and drabs, two and three here, eight there. You think of master and commander; they had a contingent of Marines, like 8 or 10 guys who would go up into the sails and fire the weapons at another ship. So it was really in a small force, really. It was about 15,000 men spread across the world, really charged with protecting American corporate interests in a lot of places, with fighting what they called the banana wars in Nicaragua or Haiti. Also protecting legations such as in China. So when war broke out, there was, say, 15,000. That was soon raised to 18,000. But ironically, when the commandant of the Marine Corps at the time, George Barnett, offered the Marine service to John Pershing and the American Expeditionary Force, he was rebuffed. They told him, "No, go talk to the Navy. We don't have any use for you." but Barnett was well-connected through his wife politically, and he was able to finally get acquiescence for the Marines to join the fight. Also, they increased the number of recruits or the size of the force to about 31,000. And they embarked on the Marines wanted the best and brightest. I mean, there was a draft going on at the time, but it was all volunteer. And the Marines went out on various campuses across the nation looking for the best and brightest. And right here in Minnesota, at the University of Minnesota, they got 500 young men to sign up at one time. They filled out two companies in the 5th and 6th Regiment. So they regarded themselves as an elite force, even then. Mm-hmm. But World War One was really what made the reputation, the birth of the modern Corps, I would say.
That's one of the things that stands out in your book, is that it was a very funny moment reading that in the book, when he is like, "The Marine Corps, what's that?" And it really points to the degree to which Cates is there at the founding of the legend. He participates in the founding of that Marine Corps legend. The things, the battles for which we know the Corps for, like Belleau Wood and New Sargon, and then you know, going on into World War II with the wars, the battles in the South Pacific, that he is there as part of that. And in a sense, his biography, especially the part that you focus on here, is the birth not so much of the Marine Corps, but the Marine Corps as we know it today.
Yeah, of the modern Corps, definitely. Yeah, I mean, he parallels that development. You know, he enlisted and became part of an officer's candidate in the Marines Reserve, took a test, was sent to Paris Island, as many, you know, young recruits were. A brutal place off of the coast of South Carolina. And then they were building another huge encampment at Quantico. We all know Quantico, Virginia now, for the Marines to train at. He was shipped there, and that's where basically the 6th Regiment was put together. It was a brand new regiment. The 5th had already gone across in June 1917 with most of the 1st Division. And they raised, regiments about 3,000 men. Cates was one of the last ones to be assigned to a company, which was the 96th Company of the 2nd Battalion, and it turned out to be not coincidentally the unit that took the most casualties of any American unit in the war. They were just in the thick of all the battles, like you mentioned, Belleau Wood, Soissons, Blancmont, and in the Argonne.
And yet your book, you're describing Cates's training at Parris Island, especially at Quantico. It's not just about him, because he also is, you know, he meets a lot of these men that they're serving with. And it's a very colorful group.
Yeah, it really is. You know, there are men from all over the place. And like I said, a lot of intelligent young men. The officers mainly came from Virginia Military Institute or these kind of places. And they were smart young guys, all eager beavers to get out and get over to France and start fighting. But they also had some colorful older Marines who'd been in the service for quite a while, had been around the world. And they were the ones who actually schooled these young officers in so many aspects of what it was to be a Marine. They had the gunny sergeants. And that there was like, yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
no, I was going to say the one of the anecdotes I was thinking of is when the red light district in near Quantico was cleaned out.
You mentioned
that story as an example.
That is a funny story. They were building Quantico from the ground up, basically. So they had thousands of workmen there, and that attracted a number of ladies in the night for their services. And finally, the commandant of Quantico wanted to get rid of him. So he sent this young officer down there, William Wharton, who was the officer of the day. He said, go down there and clean him out, put him on a train and get him out of here. And one of the gunnies, just as a joke, had one of the ladies come up and kiss Wharton affectionately before she got on the train. And the red-faced Wharton was just beside himself. And then the commandant's like, how did you know that woman? You know, kind of thing. So he had protested very much for his own honor, yeah.
Part of me was wondering the degree to which that was not just a matter of, you know, having fun, but also the old salt who is...
Yeah, it's a bit of hazing.
Definitely. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Welcome to the Corps. So, yeah. And there was another instance when they were about to leave, the 2nd Battalion was about to leave for France the night before. All the officers got together in a barracks and started drinking at a big party. And they had it was in January, so there's a fire going. And one of them at some point decided he wanted to see what would happen if he threw a bullet into the stove. And, of course, what happened was it went off. And so they started just throwing all these bullets there. And Wharton again, comes running over. And he's like, you have to stop this. You're drunk. Stop. And they take him, they tie him to the bed, and then they pour liquor down his throat. And he leaves and then goes, gets like this tough gunny sergeant, and who they cower before. Him they listen to. You know, they finally broke up the party. And but Wharton had the last laugh. He got to get him up at like 5 o'clock in the morning when they're all hungover to start in training for France.
So they leave from New York Harbor in January of 1918, and they cross, and as you mentioned, for some of them, this is their first time at sea, which is kind of ironic considering that they're in the Marine Corps, and mm-hmm. many of them find that being at sea is not when they're at their best.
Right.
But then they get to France, and they begin this process of preparing for service at the Western Front.
Right. Well, the 5th Marines had been sent sort of all over France to work really boring details at railroad depots, this kind of stuff, the previous June. The 6th Regiment, however, when it landed, it went trained directly for the Vosges area, and they began the slow process of getting equipped and getting their feet wet in the trenches. It was a quiet area. But just, you know, they get an idea of what it's like to live in the trenches. And by degrees, they start coming into contact with the Germans who are across no man's land from them. Firefights erupt, shellings. So, that was very common in World War I, is sort of like they would sort of just initiate troops into these trench or into these areas where you wouldn't expect a full-scale assault by the Germans. But there was going to be some activity. There was going to be some gas. There was going to be artillery shelling, machine guns. So The six Marines started to get their feet wet in the spring of 1918.
Now, the situation in which they found themselves was unlike the type of combat for which they've been preparing. Could you explain for our listeners a bit what warfare, what combat was like during World War One, and how the Americans and the Marines in particular approached facing trench warfare?
Well, you know, famously there had been a stalemate since the fall of 1914 between the Allies and the Germans and their allies, the Austro-Hungarians. And through the ensuing years, breakthroughs were attempted, but never achieved anything. I mean, famously, I think the British lost 40,000 men on the first day of the Somme battle in 1916. They thought they could just bombard the German trenches for a week or a month and then send men over, but the Germans were down below, 30, 40 feet below. They just climbed back up, manned their machine guns, and just mowed them down in lines. This went on and on. And Americans being what they are, you know, John Pershing especially, and the Marine Corps, it's like they didn't understand what the problem was. You know, they just thought, when we get over there, we're going to do a big breakthrough. Our divisions are going to be bigger, working as one, and we're just going to break through this trench stalemate and win this war and get out of here. You know, the Marines in particular sort of poo-pooed the power of the machine gun, which really, of course, had dominated the war. There's really no answer for well-sighted machine guns. So they believed in massed rifle power, and the Marines, in fact, stressed marksmanship very much, and so they were all good shots. But the Marines at Belleau Wood would find out in their first taste of real combat that just, you know, walking across a wheat field towards a fortified position is going to get you in a lot of trouble real fast. Yeah. They found that out on June 6, 1918. The Germans had launched this massive offensive on May 27th. They were streaming south. They're trying to draw the French from their positions further to the east, draw them down, and then they wanted in the north to attack the British and push them into the sea. Anyway, the Marines were sent to halt this drive at a place that was Belleau Wood, which was a royal hunting little copse of woods about a mile long, half a mile deep. That's when they first really encountered the Germans in force. They got there about June 1st, and sort of just, it was inertia or what it was. They just kind of waited. The French were filtering through, surrendering, throwing their weapons down, saying, you know, the Germans are coming, get out of here, crazy Americans. But they held their ground, the Americans did. And unfortunately, they didn't believe that the Germans had entered the Belleau Wood. So they just let it sit for a while. But in fact, the Germans had infiltrated in depth and had set up machine gun nests everywhere. It was a very rocky, rugged place. And so when the Americans finally did attack on the morning of June 6, 1918, they were mowed down. It was the 5th Regiment, two battalions of the 5th Regiment went in on the left, and they got slaughtered, basically, stymied, had to go to ground. And then later in the afternoon, they tried a more concerted effort on the left in the center with a battalion of the 6th Marines, and then Cliff Cates and the 96th Company on the right was to take the town of Bresch, which was a key site because you could enfilade the woods from there. So at 5 o'clock, this concerted push across the field went on, and to varying degrees of success, the 6th Regiment battalion just got barely a foothold in the southern portion of the woods. Again, on the left, hardly anybody got into the woods, and a lot of them died trying. And Cliff Cates and his company went across this 800-yard-wide field under full view of the Germans at this village of Bresch, and immediately were caught in a swarm of machine gun bullets and artillery rounds. Cliff sort of imagine somebody sort of waiting before a rainstorm, sort of bent over, takes a bullet off his helmet and creates this huge dent in it. he gets knocked out, and he says when he came to, he didn't know how long it had been, but his first thought was to run away. So that was his first taste of combat. But he being Cliff Cates, he looks to his right. He sees three or four of his men over there. He stumbles over there through machine gun fire, and he's got a nasty lump on his head from where a bullet hit his helmet. And one of his men starts pouring wine on it, and Cliff tells him, "Don't pour it on my head. Give me a drink." So he takes a big hard swallow of wine and picks up an abandoned French rifle and says, "Come on, boys, let's go." 20 guys go in and take the village, basically. And then through the night, reinforcements trickle in to help them.
But yeah. They're fighting Belleau Wood for about 2.5 weeks.
And it's really, it's from the time they got there, say June 1st, June 2nd, it wasn't really declared free of Germans till June 26th. So it was really, 3.5 weeks.
And your book is very evocative of all of that, the dangers that they face. The artillery shelling was constant. One of the things that struck me in terms of machine guns was how all the quotes that you have of the men who were commenting, it seemed like every German had a machine gun. They were facing so many of them. But there was another threat that was more occasional, but could be just as deadly, and that was mustard gas.
Yeah, that was a really insidious poison, and the Germans began using it in 1915 against the French, and it burned the skin. If you inhaled it, it burned the lining of your lungs, left blisters everywhere. Men died from it. Cliff Cates and his company and the 78th Company that were on June 13th, they'd spent the day kind of in the back lines, and they were supposed to go into Belleau Wood that night at midnight. And they were under the observation of Germans in balloons who watched them kind of lolling in this back area through the day. And at midnight, as they were lining up for chow in preparation to go into the woods that night, they just became under this deluge of high explosives and mustard gas shells. And basically, by the time it was over, about an hour or so later, Cates was writing that his company was defunct. Everybody was either dead or wounded. He suffered burns. But they called him Lucky Cates. He took the machine gun bullet off his helmet, the mustard gas. There were many instances of where he should have been killed but wasn't. He was smart. He actually went into the woods, pretty much attached himself to the 80th Company, but he used soap and water to take care of his burns, and that's what needed to be done. Some of these guys panicked. They couldn't stand the gas mask they had. They ripped them off, and they died in ambulances on the way to the hospital. It was a horrible night.
Yeah, one of the things you mentioned about the effects of the gas, you talk about how oily mustard gas is, and how even if they survived the shelling, it soaked into their clothing. That was one of the stories you describe in there, was the soldier who basically ripped off his mask because he hated the fact that he couldn't see very well out of it. It was fogging up, and he's like, "I'm never going to wear that again." And even though the shelling had stopped, the gas had permeated his clothes. And yeah. So he was one of those who died before he could get treatment.
Yeah, and in some instances, it was 5 or 6 or 7 very, very painful, horrible days later that they finally died. Fred Stockham, gunnery sergeant of the 96th Company, went to the aid of a young Marine who had cracked his gas mask, I believe, and Fred gave him his own gas mask and carried him out of there. Then went back into the affected area to help other people, and he wound up dying about 6 days later in the hospital. It got in his lungs, and there's no getting it out of there. It was very common, really, after the war, to read of doughboys and Marines alike, dying young, dying in their 30s and 40s from, or even 50s, from the effects that they had been gassed. So everything you hear. Everybody knows about gas in World War I. It's true.
But Cates, as you mentioned, as you have already said, he survives this, obviously. He survives relatively unscathed compared to so many of his comrades. And he comes out of Belleau Wood, and he ends up receiving quite a few citations for his valor.
Oh yeah, yeah. By the time the war was done, he had silver stars, Navy crosses. His battalion commander Thomas Holcomb put him in for a Medal of Honor. Instead, they gave him a Distinguished Service Cross, which was sort of for a body of work. Mm-hmm. But he certainly, like I say in the book, you know, he wasn't Sergeant Alvin York, who basically fought one day. And, you know, it was a very big day for Alvin. But, you know, he had captured 136 Germans and all this. So it was very, you know, it's hard to ignore. But Cliff's body of work, you know, was to lead his men in attack at Belleau Wood and at Soissons and up Blancmont in October. I mean, he was always at the head. They stand in July 19th in the morning. They're going to assault across this huge, another huge flat field towards the Germans and their machine guns and artillery. And they're just waiting for the French tanks to come up. And a spent bullet, German bullet, lands in his shoulder. It's like, yeah, look at me. I got the first wound, you know. It was like, of course. It's just, he was a magnet for these things, but they were never mortal wounds. And he always just kind of shrugged them off. That's really who he was. He was a natural leader of men. It's something that I don't know if you can even teach. You know, a good example of who Cliff was when at Belleau Wood, they selected a small coterie of Marines to go to Paris for 4th of July parade. And Cliff, of course, because of his heroism and actions, was selected. And he took 20 men with him. And they get to Paris, and all the men are flat broke because they've been at Belleau Wood for a month and haven't gotten paid. But Cliff had saved his money, and he doled out his money, about 80 francs apiece, which is about $9 apiece, to each of the men, so they could go in Paris and, you know, get a meal and a bottle of wine or whatever. So then that – he even said, you know, boy, you know, they'd follow me anywhere after that. But he knew instinctively that that's – you got to take care of your men. He was always talking about his men. At Samuel, it's the only battle he didn't participate in because they began a routine of picking 10% of the company, about 20, 25 men, and leaving them behind so that when the battle was over, they could form the nucleus of a new company. That's how optimistic they were about, you know, their casualties at that point. Mm-hmm. And so Cliff was one of those left behind. But he was so worried about his men, he went up to the line the first night they were in just to check on them, see if they're okay. They came back a couple of days later after more of a ambush skirmish than a real live fight, but there were deaths, there were wounded people, and he rousted up a great feed. So when they came off the line, they had a barrel of wine, they had food. This is just a guy who was, like I say, a great leader, a great combat leader.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, though, he doesn't just serve in Belleau Wood, he also serves at Soissons. Distinguishes himself there as well. He goes from being second lieutenant to first lieutenant during this period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Soissons, like I mentioned earlier, was this great counteroffensive, and the 1st Division and Moroccans and the three regiments of the 2nd Division made great progress in the first day, July 18th of 1918, moving basically about 5 miles east through the German lines, which in World War I terms was huge. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's an Onion article. One of the world histories, the headline was something like, you know, 400,000 killed to move 6 inches, you know, kind of thing. So that's really what you think about when you think World War One. So 5 miles was great. Mm-hmm. But the 6th Regiment then on the 19th was to take over the same sector that their compadres had the day before. But now the Germans have brought up reinforcements, artillery, there's sausage balloons, you know, looking at them to spot for artillery. There are planes. So they had an advance that lasted 45 minutes to an hour, basically people just getting slaughtered left and right, the Marines. They basically all had to go to ground. But the title of the book comes from something that Cliff had written during that. He had to go to ground too, but at the same time, he was a man of action. He's antsy. He wants to know what the situation is. He's afraid that the Germans are going to counterattack. So he goes bopping around the field, taking pot shots. People are shooting at him. But he wanted to see the disposition of the forces. 10:30 in the morning, he came back and wrote a memo basically saying, I have, you know, 20 men here from 5 different companies. We're surrounded. We're taking artillery shells, machine guns. And he signed it off by saying, I will hold. So I know it wasn't just bravado. He was ready to fight to the end. In the end, it just turned into a long, hot day. The Germans did not make an advance, and the 6th Regiment was relieved when darkness fell. But It was a terrible day for the 6th Regiment, and the gains were not worth it.
He also, at that point, though more broadly speaking, the war has really turned. The company is deployed to the front lines at the peak of the Operation Michael, which was the massive 1918 German offensive, and by July, that offensive has pretty much petered out. It was really the last throw of the German army, and at that point, you start to see these counterattacks, which really begin to affect the sort of territorial gains that hadn't really been seen on the Western Front in nearly 4 years.
Well, they call it the Battle of Soissons. They call it the turning of the tide, for sure. With the advance of July 18th and even a minimal advance of the 19th, the Germans began pulling out of that pocket below Soissons, and that was the last time they moved forward. I mean, that was it. From that point on, they were retreating back to Germany, basically. So it became a matter really of almost rear guard actions. They were trying to hold out to get the best terms they could of any peace that was going to come along. People were thinking maybe this will be over in summer of 19. People were really thinking that way because it was just they put up a great stiff defense even as they were strategically withdrawing towards the fatherland. But it's true. All along the line, better gains were being made by the Allies from north to south, including for Cliff Cates at Blancmont. It was a part of the structure of heights above Reims, where the French had attacked for years and lost hundreds of thousands of men. Finally, Ferdinand Foch, the marshal of the Allies, asked for four American divisions to help try to break through. And instead, Pershing sent him two. He sent him the 2nd Division and the untried 36th Division. Well, Cliff Cates was first in line with his 96th Company on the morning of October 3rd, went up this long, arching, I'd say it's about a mile and a half long, just this long elevation, heavily fortified wire, redoubts, artillery, machine guns, and got to the top. And basically found themselves kind of cut off. The 5th Marines were following them, and their left was up in the air because the French weren't able to advance on the left. So it was a very busy time for Cliff Cates. He was directing tanks to come up to beat off counterattacks on his left. Nobody really knew what the situation was ahead of them. But that was another great victory. Was called, I think Henri Mangin, the French general, called it, the key victory of 1918.
And a little more than a month later, the Germans get the armistice. The fighting comes to an end. They're in the period of peace. Where does the 96th Company then go?
Well, the 96th Company and the Marines in general, I think they picked six divisions to occupy the bridgehead in the Cologne area, Koblenz area. So they started marching about a week after the armistice. They started marching towards Germany through Luxembourg and then into Germany itself. They stopped to urinate in the Rhine, as Churchill famously would do 45 or whatever years later. And then they just basically took up occupation duty. Each company was basically assigned a village. And it was a boring time, but true to form, the Marines didn't let their men get fat and sassy. They worked them harder than they ever had in their lives, knowing that idle hands are the devil's tools, right? So they occupied that area until June. But in the meantime, Cliff was picked to be part of a composite company. It was a very honorary deal where they went and accompanied Pershing on his grand marches through London and Paris and this throughout the spring of 1919. And so he was like a captain, say, of what would have been maybe a small company of men who'd served with distinction in World War I. And then in the summer of 1919, finally, I believe it was August, the 96th Company finally rotated home, and Cliff didn't know what he was going to do. He'd had a fantastic career But he wasn't really thinking about staying in the Marine Corps. He was thinking more like, I'll go back and hang up a shingle in Knoxville or Memphis or whatever and become a lawyer. But
and just to put in there, is that, you know, we've been talking about this, you know, very, you know, this very dramatic period of his life. It's really been only a little more than 2 years.
Oh,
so
yeah, yeah.
We're talking about a young man who's still in his mid-20s, for whom, as it would be for many millions of American men, this could have been just a period of his life from which he would move on. That's how, as you present, that's how he's sort of thinking about it at that point.
Yeah, he was 25 years old. And one of the interesting thing about Cliff Cates is I actually put a little vignette, a little counterstroke in the book. You know, you also get the Lost Generation stuff with all the, you know, the that generation of English, American, whatever, who fought in World War One. Great sentimentality, bitterness. Think of a book like Company K or Through the Wheat on the American side. Cliff Cates didn't display any sort of post-traumatic stress or anything from that. It was something that I don't think even occurred to him. He just loved the work, and he was sorry about losing so many men in the company as he did, and he set out, when he finally did, make a career in the Marines. He told himself he's never going to let that happen to any men he's leading again. He just thought they didn't really have tactics. They said their only tactic was to get up and go in the World War One. Anyway, so they disbanded the 96 company for good, forever, at Quantico, I think in mid-August 1919. And Cliff was going to resign and just, you know, go back to Memphis, whatever he's going to do. But he happened to be strolling across Quantico, and he saw George Barnett, the commandant, coming towards him. And he said before he could hide, Barnett had kind of sort of buttonholed him and said, "Young man, I hear you're planning on resigning." And he said, "Yeah." Cliff said, "Yeah." And Barnett told him, "Look, well, if you just give it a few weeks to think about it, okay, this kind of thing." And so that's how highly he was regarded, even a 25-year-old, barely even a captain. He was a captain by the time the war ended, but not by much. He'd actually been leading the unit as a second lieutenant and wound up staying with the Corps. He served as an assistant for Barnett. He recruited, and he did a couple years in China with the Marine Legation there. And then when war broke out, Thomas Holcomb, his battalion commander in World War One, was by then commandant, and he offered Cates, or gave Cates, I don't know if they really offer it, command of the 1st Marine Regiment, and off they went to Guadalcanal, and that's a famous battle.
The anecdote that you describe in there that really stands out for me is the one about the Japanese sub and the shelling.
So it's so classic. I mean, Cliff Cates, when there was a German plane flying over the lines, he'd pull out his .45 and shoot at it. I mean, this is what he was renowned for. And he swears to God he saw the fabric fly on one plane. He almost brought it down at Soissons. And so they get to Guadalcanal, and there's this nasty little Japanese submarine about 3 miles off that's, you know, firing at him. And it keeps doing it. I think they called him Lousy Louie or something like that. And Cates finally just says, you know, go get that shore battery, bring it over here, and try to get that submarine. And everybody's like, what? And he's like, you know, he's like, no, do it. And in more colorful language than that. And so finally, they start firing at the submarine, and Cates thinks they hit the fantail. He can't be sure, but it's just typical of him. You know what? I'm not going to sit here and take a pounding by anybody. I'm going to give some back, you know?
And as you point out, the sub didn't return.
No, it did not return. That was it for Lucky Louie or whatever his name was, Lousy Louie. So, yeah. And then Cliff went on to command the 4th Marine Division at Iwo Jima, where he really could not really harness the casualties that were suffered there. It was just such a horrible place. But he was – his attitude about war and his how he continued to lead his men was forged in World War One. Time Magazine, when he became commandant in 1949, I believe – or 47, and Time Magazine, when he finally retired, said, you know, simply he liked the work, and that's who Cliff Cates was. He was was a Marine, and he just loved the work that he was doing.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Sort of thinking about a book, World War One again, about several companies and the horrible experience they had, American companies from the 28th Division. Sort of just thinking about it right now.
Have you thought about returning to doing that biography of Clifton Cates?
You know, when I Penguin obtained the book, and I was explaining what had happened to my editor, and he was sort of like, "Well, I don't think we want a full bio. I think the dramatic stuff is World War One, and if you want to do more of a study of command, I think kind of thing, which is a little beyond my ken, you could take a look at Cates in World War Two. There's certainly enough material in letters that I never even really saw if you want to flesh it out, but I don't really think I want to do that.
Well, Jim, thank you very much for your time. Thanks for speaking to us today about your study of Clifton Cates and World War One, and I hope you have a wonderful day.